It was the head roll for me.
One day we'll
I don't know.
Yes, wonderful.
I feel like it's been forever. Like what? So the last time we recorded was early February. Mm-hmm. So yep. It's been a while. I am definitely looking forward to the guests that we have on today. And not only just that, but the conversations I feel like we're going to be really diving into. End of Women's History Month is almost over. I just want to again shout out Sophie and Mary for your contributions to the podcast. We appreciate you guys.
It's truly my honor.
Wonderful game.
Thank you, Mary.
Right on time. We have the one and only Cindy Foley.
Thank you.
New, almost a year in as the Grampus Art Museum CEO and executive director.
Amazing.
So, again, thank you for being here.
So excited.
So I recently joined the Grams board September last year. And we are able to obviously meet and talk about, just some of your aspirations and things for the Gram specifically. And then just good conversations around art and those type of things. So I was like, yeah, you want to be on a podcast? And you were like, yeah. So, glad to have you. So I just want to kind of start in terms of like, I was thinking about this the other day, like I don't know anybody that aspires to be an executive director of an art museum. So I guess like
that's kind
of take a right. Like what's your dream?
It's very specific.
I get there. Yeah, like how do you get there? So I guess first kind of take us back to like how did art come into your life? Go from there.
Yeah. So first off, thanks for having me. This is an honor and I'm a big fan. So
Thank you.
I think to start, I'm probably untypical as far as my path, but I think it's valuable. I'm glad you asked. Mm-hmm. So my introduction to art really started with my grandfather. Mm. He was a pipe fitter, never went to college, but he had taken a class in high school, an art class, and someone had said, "You're really good." So after he retired, he picks up painting again. And here's a guy that, the only access to art he had was picking up some books in like thrift stores and, like these how to paint kind of things. So he starts painting, he finds Bob Ross at a certain point. I mean,
doesn't everybody?
As one does. Yeah. I mean, it's the way. But as a kid, here I was going to his house and my mom would drop us off at the weekend and I'd spend time and down in the basement where my grandmother had her cans, she was canning. Mm-hmm. On the other side was my grandfather's studio. Mm. And I fell in love with watching him. And you'd come from week to week and he was really interested in the history. He grew up in Southern Ohio and the history of Ohio and the Ohio River. And he'd find an old photograph and he'd try to recreate it and put little people in and imagine. Oh. Mm. And we'd have these great conversations. And that's how it started.
Wow.
With an untrained artist, untrained artist who, but it was the passion, the something that about him that, there's 12 cousins on that side of the family. Mm. Ends up, six of us end up in the arts in some way, shape, or form.
Wow.
You got to tell me, right? That had some sort of influence. Yeah. Our parents weren't in creative fields, but that one grandfather like planted a seed. So for me, that was the beginning. And I think then, you know, like anyone, I was like, yeah, I'm going to take some art classes. I will admit, I was curious about art, you know, maybe not as, let's just say my practice was not as intentional as other artists, but I knew that this is the world I wanted to be in. So that led me to college, where I didn't know what I wanted to do, really, but it had to encompass something. So I was I enrolled and thought I'd be a studio major, but my mom, good old mom for you. We're on the campus tour, and we happened by the little art museum on the University of Kentucky campus. And she walks up to the desk, and she's like, because she's more concerned about me getting work study, right? And she says, do you all have work study? Because she needs work study.
Shout out to mom.
And I got a work study position and haven't left the museum field since.
Wow.
Whoa.
So
mom knows best.
Yeah. And, you know, for mom, it was like, you got to help pay for college here.
Right.
So, so, you know, her intentions, but she also loved this idea that, you know, here I was, I had a fascination and a curiosity, and the rest is history.
Nice.
Very nice. Wow. So before the Gram, you were the art director or the CEO at the Columbus.
So I was a deputy director, meaning I oversaw, a big portion of the institution, curatorial, education, operations side of it. So, you know, I think you hit plateau. So to answer your question from earlier, did I think I was going to be a museum director? No, I started off as a guard in an art museum. I was guard, and then I worked at the front desk. And, I think I just got excited about what else could I do? And so that led me to, I just keep following that trail until you hit a point where you think, museums can do better. And you start pushing for what you think should change. And you find walls and resistance. And for me, I think each jump in evolution was less about my aspirational goals and more about like, but I believe we can do better. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, you'd sit with your colleagues and you'd think, you know, things have got to change. Why is leadership not leading in the way we want it to go? And
Your perspective in each position that you've had has shed light on these adversities.
And I think for me, I came from a very different background. I wasn't someone who, you know, I've gotten to go to museums as a kid, but, you know, I grew up in Southern Ohio. I'm Appalachian, you know, and that's not what you think of when you imagine a museum director. And the way I've gotten to this job hasn't been from a curatorial perspective or a deep art historical. It's not that I didn't like art history, but I loved people and I loved education. I loved what could happen in a museum space. And I think that's starting out on the floor, right? Starting out on the floor of the museum and seeing how, like, what made people cry? What made them laugh? What made them hug in the middle of an experience? And then all of a sudden you're thinking, that's what a museum experience is about, is what happens between people, what happens when ideas are triggered, and how do we be more intentional about that? So I came from an educational perspective, and I'm a people-centered point of view, which I think is a bit radical, but but more and more educators are being hired into roles like museum directors. So did I think I was going to get here? No, because I never thought they'd ever see someone like me in that role. But here I am.
Wow. So on the, just thinking about like the progression from like, okay, going to a guard, going to these other positions, I guess, are there, I guess, how did your perspective change from those different positions? And I guess, what are some things that you, I guess, saw as you, like, you know, your position changed from different throughout the museum?
Here's where I'll be a little vulnerable and name no names, but I do remember being a guard, and someone had asked me, oh, could, it was an opening or something. Could mm-hmm. you point out the director of the museum? I'd like to speak to her. And I remember going over and saying, Ms., and I won't say your last name, this patron would like to speak to you. So they talked. She came up to me afterwards and said, I am doctor. Don't you ever introduce me as Mrs. again. And that's just one of those things mm-hmm. that stuck to me. Like, what did I thought I was so respectful.
Right. Makes you question.
I'm here. I was your female director. I, you know, like a 19-year-old kid. And I'm thinking, how was that wrong?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the seeds come in, right? Where I could either go self-doubt, which trust me, there's been a lot of self-doubt in this world, or you say, really? You know, are we so above everyone that you think you needed to call me out for that? So I think there's been like probably a number of those types of experiences where I've had to reflect on, okay, do I love this field enough that I'm going to stick with it, or, you know, is it time to bail? And
is that what you were hinting at earlier when you said resistance?
Internal
resistance.
Yeah, okay. Internal resistance. You know, I think resistance can come from a lot of places.
Sure.
But I think museums have struggled with themselves. Let's be honest.
That was a bar.
They are institutions built on colonialist practice.
Oh, come on.
Facts.
Yeah.
Talk about it.
And if you think about it, you know, the entire history of museums is based on a group of people who said, in you know, the whitewashed way of looking at it, look at these amazing objects from across the globe. Come in and see them on curiosity cabinets or, you know, wondercomers, where they were referred to. But what they were is, I've stolen these objects from the peoples of the globe. And, you know, now I want to enlighten you. And granted, you know, people actually got to see things they'd never seen before. But it was the framing that we held on to that somehow we were doing a favor to society. And we never acknowledged the harm. You know, I mean, I think we're just now starting to really say, what harm happened as we you know, scoured the globe, you know, and really often, you know, just acquired these on behalf of our own power and privilege. So, you know, if you want to start there, that's one of the challenges I think museums have had to address. And you know, they being able to say those things out loud to this day are very difficult for some.
Sure.
But that gives you a sense. It's everything from the academic, you know, I'm a doctor, to but it was about, these are spaces of power and privilege. But I come from my mom was in public education, my dad worked for the government, and I think, you know, when you have to think through it through different lenses, you start to question. And my youngest sister, Molly, you know, I have three sisters. One of them goes into government, which, you know, crazy Julie. And then my younger sister, though, I think we were all, you know, influenced by the same group of parents. And my youngest sister is an administrator in the library. And she and I have probably spent more hours than we can count talking about the changing nature of these public spaces. Mm-hmm. I do have to admit, libraries are probably 20 years ahead of museums.
Wow.
And the reason is about 20 years ago, the big question was asked, are these spaces about books? Are they about people? And there was a huge fight.
Great question.
Right?
Great question.
And what you've seen over the past 20 years is the books are there, but they're in support of people.
Right.
Because now libraries are spaces where you learn job skills. Libraries are spaces where you get homework help. Libraries are spaces where you can, English as a second language classes are taught there. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are unhoused, it's a place, a safe place to find a restroom. Mm-hmm. So our libraries have shifted. Now it's time for museums to begin that same journey, I think.
Mm. Mm.
That's a good thought. Good thought.
So much.
So how much mm-hmm. how much pushback is happening with that thought? That is a radical thought.
Yeah.
It's a very radical thought.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the pushback, this is why we're in a sweet moment. I'm an Xer, you know, of a particular generation, and we're the generation that, like, I think we saw it all and didn't know what to do with it. And the pushback often came from the generation before.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've got this whole other group coming in. They're like, fuck this.
No, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
And so what I think my generation has done well is we're navigating these folks, the ones that were before us, the ones that corrected me for the title misstep.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to balance, like, the next generation that are like, tear the thing down.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think I need the radicals on the one side. And I need to help the generation that came before that did amazing things feel good and step away. Help them step away with pride and hand off to the next generations to think about the work that needs to happen next.
Okay.
I do feel that there, you know, this is that tension point between, like, education and curatorial. It's been the biggest place of challenge, I think, in museums. And what I love is, for example, at Graham, that's not the case, because what you've got is curators that think like educators and educators that think like curators. And so the lines are starting to blur. The tensions between those departments kind of aren't non-existent, or if they're anything, they're pushing each other.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a whole new paradigm.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Well, and even think about this, and maybe the place where it can change are spaces like Graham, spaces that aren't academic, museums that have every art movement, and, you know, those massive museums or Cleveland, or the challenge with them changing is you have to hire, or they believe you have to hire, experts. So what you have is a curatorial department, which is full of all of these experts. Mm. And the expert, you know, the research around creativity and expertise tells you a lot, because what they say is, if you identify yourself as an expert, that means you often hold on to the research that you've discovered, and you're very reluctant to let new research come in. If you identify, if you identify as a learner, even though you may be an expert in a field, you are far more open to saying more stuff. Come on in.
Really.
Like,
you're more receptive.
Let's think about what happens next. And so I think it's how some of these folks in museums have identified. Are they experts and they want to hunker down and this is my area of expertise and I don't go outside of that? Or am I a learner? And so now you're starting to get museum departments in smaller museums who are saying, I think we're all learners. Let's just learn together.
It's good stuff.
Amazing.
Go ahead,
I love that that's kind of happening at the Graham, in like the curation learning.
Yeah.
The lines are blurring. That's amazing, because there's been such, just as someone who goes to the museum, there's been so much stagnation at the museum.
Yeah.
And you can feel it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, even our curators, they studied in art history and they have a background, but both of them also have a background in education, which I think is key.
Yeah.
And both of them will tell you, I'm a generalist. I'm not an expert. I have a wide curiosity about a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not afraid when, you know, we say something like, I think we should do a show on sneakers. Right? Like, some folks would be like, whoa, no, you know, because we don't have expertise where that, you know, that would be other certain kind of museums should do that.
Mm-hmm.
They're curious. So they'll say, all right, well, let's start finding out what the whole, what is sneaker culture all about? What is the visual culture around sneakers about? You know, I'm giving you an example of something that is, you know, hush-hush, but these are conversations we're having.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, but they also are willing to, you know, the current show is on the border between Mexico and the U.S. And they realize, like, oh, I'm not an expert in politics either, but I feel that artists are having conversations that politicians aren't having, and, right. and I'm Absolutely. Curious about that. So
yeah.
I need to work with curators that think in that way.
They have passion.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like you have to be that way if you're passionate about something. You have to be open to learning new things.
And passion about the way we live in a society with human beings.
And humanity.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Versus Absolutely. The objects being always on the pedestal. It's like the objects tell us
good.
A story
yes. that's yes. good.
About
that's
good. Humanity. Right. But it's really still about People. Humanity. So,
Oof.
Yeah.
Mm. Goosebumps. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, there's so much. So there's and a lot of this tying to a lot of the questions I already have. So you did I think it was called The Art of Thinking Differently in November last mm-hmm. year, an event which I loved. And a lot of it was surrounding curiosity, creativity, play, and those type of things. Yeah, can you kind of get a snippet of that event? Because I know you guys weren't there. And then just kind of dive into some of the importance of curiosity, as adults, of course.
Yeah. So I think there's two reasons why I started a deep dive into creativity and then all these other areas. Mm-hmm. One is because I ended up marrying a artist, meaning, I studied art, but I realized where my creative life would be in a space like a museum. But I married a guy who... He has a studio practice, and he is constantly, he's a transdisciplinary researcher. He's constantly out there. And so I was curious about this human that now I lived with, right? But then I had kids. Mm. And I will tell you, for me, it was as much, having children is wonderful, but watching their human development and understanding how kids think, and as I'm watching them evolve as these humans, and finding that actually our society was doing everything in its power to strip away what was brilliant and beautiful about these humans that I was raising was horrifying. Mm. And so in Columbus, I had the opportunity... I had a director there that I worked for who said, Cindy, I'm worried about this museum. I'm worried that in 20 years we won't be relevant, and there could be a chance a place like this might not exist in 50 years. And I feel like as a director, I got to make a change. What do you think I should do? And, it's like, well, she knows I have ideas, but but I remember not having an answer for it right away. And I went and thought about it for quite a bit, but I ended up, I was going on vacation with my husband to Provincetown, Massachusetts. Mm. And Provincetown is this really wonderful, quirky place on the very tip of Cape Cod. And the reason we were going is he was an artist in residence. Mm. And it's a place where artists come together. They come together to think. They more or less, it's the pre-era of podcasts. It was how do artists connect ideas? How do they share? How do they elevate each other? And so, we're going to spend our week away with a whole group of other artists. Mm. And I get there and I realize this is what museums need to be thinking about, is how does creativity happen? How do we feed our own creativity? When you walk around a museum, you see some of the most incredible byproducts of human creativity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But let's think about it. Human creativity made it possible. So what are we doing to cultivate human creativity? And that then, combined with my concern about what was happening with my kids, I realized we are losing it. We are creating an entire generation where we're stripping away creativity. The research shows right now that, for decades and decades, the U.S. was considered the place where everyone needed to study creativity. And we were growing. Our IQ scores and creativity scores from about the 1960s forward would bump up about 10 points every year. Mm. So every decade, I mean. Every decade, we'd have these incredible bumps. So you get people from Norway, Singapore, Finland coming to the U.S. starting in the 70s and the 80s saying, what the heck happens in the U.S. in which these kind of thinkers are emerging? And, you know, then they go on to model us. But about the 1990s, something starts happening in the U.S. in which IQ scores continue to increase. Creativity scores begin to plummet. Any guesses on what happens in the 1990s? Well, it's not good. And it probably had an impact even on you, introduction of standardized tests. We did not have standardized tests before the 90s. So at the moment we have standardized tests, they immediately start to see a decline in our ability to generate ideas and to do something with those ideas. That's also coupled two other interesting things that are happening in the 90s. I don't know if you all remember the stories of like JonBenet Ramsey. It was the first time in our American history where we started televising what horrible things could happen to children. I mean, it wasn't that horrible things didn't happen to children, but all of a sudden there becomes this societal, like, fear around, like, oh, we can't send our kids outside. We can't let our kids. You know, I come from that. I was raised in the 70s and 80s, and you know, we were feral. We, you know, like, and, you know, you'd be like, I'm on my bike. I'm gone for the day. I'll see you later. We'd eat at somebody's house. I don't know who. And, you know, but, you know, by the 1990s, parents are worried. And I don't want to give any parent guilt, but they were doing things like passive media. It's the beginning of, you know, we had television, but now we also had passive media. So kids, at the same time, they're having to move away from imaginative learning in school, and they're just teaching to a test. We see this unbelievable decline. And the 90s is just the beginning. And so, you know, there was even a new research study that just came out post-COVID that said, unfortunately, COVID could have been that moment where we shifted and we let kids like immerse, be bored and like be engaged in the world. And we didn't. We closed it back down. And now they're back to school and they're so afraid that those test scores have fallen. They're doubling down on teaching to a test versus teaching, you know, to be curious. Kids don't bring their curiosities and pursue those. They just are told this is what you need to learn. So my passion came from those two places, but I started to realize that spaces like museums, we couldn't depend on schools to cultivate creativity. We had to look elsewhere, and I realized that's where a museum could come in. That's, you know, we're that could be our superpower in society in the next 50 to 100 years. Is like, why don't we be the space that actually cultivates thinking? So, to go back to your point, that's why I did that workshop. I started doing these little workshops to kind of say, like, how do we do it? Yeah,
and it's incredible because you wouldn't think before this point or this conversation, me personally, like, you would go to a museum to learn or be creative. You go there to browse or to whatever, you know, there's many different things you know, can go to a museum for, but if I want to learn something, I go to the library or I go to like a community center or some sort.
Yeah.
I go to school, but to actually learn, you don't think of a museum. That is very interesting.
Right.
Yeah. To and be it, able to learn that. But learn creativity.
You're identifying the paradigm shift. You're actually putting your finger on that tension that that we were experiencing internally, because of course I think internally folks were like, but that's not what museums are for. And there's those of us around the edges like, well, why not?
They can be whatever.
Yeah. Why not? We don't know have another, where's the place where it's happening?
Exactly. Right.
If we celebrate human creativity, if we feel the artist is the most powerful thinker on the planet, shouldn't we be cultivating that? Shouldn't that be our our superpower?
Why not?
Oof.
Ooh.
Good. That's really good.
Yeah, that's so this leads me to your TED Talk that you did.
Oh my gosh. And there fantastic. Were 9 years ago, which is crazy.
Yeah.
That was 9 years ago and it's just echoes.
Right. Crazy.
Crazy.
So there was three, you were talking about like, so teaching like an artist, mm-hmm. you talked about specifically habits that artists have. And it was comfort with ambiguity, idea generation, and transdisciplinary research. Mm-hmm. I guess kind of go into like why those things are so important for educators, and just in general too.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I will tell you, doing a TED Talk, I'd do this any day, but doing a TED imagine. Talk is hard, and it took years off my life.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know if you notice at the end of it, I think I'm so emotionally exhausted, and my voice cracks, and I nearly like start crying at the end of the TED Talk. So I love this format much better. but it was important for me at that moment. Someone knew I was passionate about this, and and how I thought the museum could do better. Right, I was asking that question. They were like, "Why don't you get on a stage and just use this as an opportunity to talk about like the field and, and art education and what you feel?" And I was like, "All right," but you know, it's been seen a lot, and in particular, I think those three points have been really, really powerful to people. So. Tolerance and comfort with ambiguity. Let me give you a story. Right after we at the museum that I used to work at in Columbus, we started doing this work. I remember we decided to do a teacher workshop. And in particular, we were working with a group of gifted educators. You know, they're working with the best students, you know, and they'd come to us and said in the morning session, they were saying, you know, our students, they just don't like open-ended projects. And every time we give them a project in which they have to pursue their own interests or, you know, take their own direction, they just shut down. And so the teachers went away for lunch. And while they were doing that, my colleagues and I, we had some ideas, and we were going to give them a twist when they came back. So they came back from lunch, and these are the educators, right? And, we gave them this project, and granted, this was a little crazy, but they came in, we blindfolded them, or we told them we were going to blindfold them and give them a pile of Legos, and we were going to have them try to make a manifestation of a concept, and the concept was, you know, something like ambiguity. They're going to have to make whatever ambiguity looks like out of Legos.
Blindfolded.
Well, here's what I learned. Almost immediately, about five educators told me, "Oh, I forgot to tell you, I was going to have to leave after lunch." So they leave. I've got another group of educators that are like, "Oh, I've got to run the restroom," even though they just come back from break.
Right.
And then there was even another group that just flat out refused to do the project. Now, granted, it was a challenging project. But what I realized in that moment is the reason kids struggle with creative prompts is because we all do. We have to build a tolerance for ambiguity. And this was the realization, and I think living with an artist and being around artists, what artists do best is they build up tolerance for not knowing. They don't know what's on the other side of this project. They don't know what the end result. They don't even know if it will be successful. But they also might get to the other side and be like, "That's not what I intended, but I'm going to make it something amazing." And artists just build up a tolerance. And so they're able to exist in a world in a different way. There isn't this judgment around knowing what you're going to do on the other side. And that's when I realized what we need to really focus on in education is building a tolerance for not knowing. We're going to exist in a world where we don't know what the end is going to be. The world is changing so quickly. We have to respond. So that was one of them, a tolerance for ambiguity. Idea generation. I think this one is like, if any of you are around a kid more than, you know, a half minute, especially a young kid, take a five-year-old. Five-year-olds are fabulous human beings, right? There's some research that shows like the average kid has like somewhere like 125 probing questions every day. And if you're a parent, good luck to you, because it's like, what? Oh, yeah. How does it rain? I don't know, you know? But they think that way. They're constantly questioning. And so what happens is as we go to school, that is actually stripped away from us. You know, there was this great research study done at NASA where they were looking for, you know, creative geniuses. And they give it, if you're applying for a job at NASA, you get this test. So, you know, thousands of people have taken this test. And what they've found is like 2% of the people that apply for jobs at NASA or in affiliated work areas of NASA, only 2% are creative geniuses. But they decided to take that test and give it to a group of students. And so they changed a little bit, but they realized they could give the similar test to different ages. And what they found, though, is at age five, 98% of children are creative geniuses, meaning they can generate ideas. They have lots of questions, you know, 98%. But that's not the statistic that blew their minds. What blew their minds is between the ages of 5 and 10, they went 98% creative genius to something like 35%. So what that told them is that actually creativity is something most of us, it's innate, it's born, and we cultivate it through our lives unless we have extreme trauma. But even for most children who even have trauma, it's actually their superpower.
Transformative.
Right? Yeah. But by the time we hit 10, what have we started? School. And we go from 98% to something in the 30s, right? And then by the time you hit the age of 15, it's down to 11%. And then it just keeps dropping throughout our lifetime. So, you know, for me, it was how do we hold on to what we did at age five so we can continue to be idea generators, curious human beings throughout our lifetime? And again, it's a quest for educators to think about. What are we teaching for? How do we actually look at artists? Because again, the role of the artist in society is to question. I'm looking around this room right now, and I know people here who are incredible questioners. They see the world differently. And they generate ideas and they want to do things with them. So my whole point wasn't that we need to be teaching capital A art education more. It was actually because I think art education has become like the rest of education, where it's almost like, why don't we teach these skills? And then we can test and see how they've done on these skills. And we'll teach them these art historical language, vocabulary, and then we'll test them on that. No, stop. Let's teach them how to think. Let's teach them how to think like artists, where they generate ideas and they're curious about the world, and they have a tolerance for that, because that's the kind of world we want to live in in the future. So,
I don't even
when I heard that on the TED Talk, it resonated so much with me, because I remember being, even in middle school, I would come home from school and I'd be like, I don't really like art class because they tell you what you have to draw. Or they tell you how to draw it, and then you turn it in, and everyone's got the same drawing. It just looks different.
Yeah.
And it's like, when did it become that?
Right. Absolutely. It's
very interesting.
Yeah.
How do you find balance in your life with your kids now?
Yeah. Well, I've got teenagers now. So, but, you know, my kids laugh a lot about, I don't know if I told you this, but I did a second TED Talk. Did I tell you about the second one? Well, that was because my kids' school district, when they were probably in like elementary school, they were doing a TED event.
Oh, yeah.
And what do you do when, you know, the superintendent of your kid's school comes to you and says, can you do another TED Talk? And it's like,
Hard to say no.
So I actually decided I would just make that TED Talk about what I'm learning from my own children, and these kind of like that stuff weighs on you when you're researching it. Right. And my poor children had to be my guinea pigs for what I did. But one of the things I think I learned is, and this was a hard one, I had to be able to endure their boredom for them to be creative thinkers. So think about this in the society we live in today. Kids, almost every minute of their lives are filled with school or some sort of activity, or they're given a device and they don't have to think about what to do next. It's just the noise fills the gaps. Yeah. And so I realized if I wanted to give my kids the opportunity to be thinkers, I needed to make them bored, which means I would have to get comfortable with them hating me, literally hating me. And I would remember, you know, they had plenty of toys. They had to, but they would nag, mom, you know, let us watch TV. Let us play. You know, why don't you play with us? You know, and you want to give in as a parent because it's just so much easier. But because I was doing this research, I knew I had to endure it. And so, you know, I would kick him out. But I remember point walking outside, and the kids were pretty young. And I was half impressed and horrified at the same moment, because they'd found these huge tubs that filled them with water. And it was like late April in Ohio. They'd filled them with water. That somehow snuck into the house, put on their bathing suits.
That's funny.
And I walk out, and they're in these huge tubs of water, and they're like, "Mom, we created our own swimming pool." And of course, the 5-year-old doesn't even swim well yet, you know, and she's immersed in a pool and April weather, and you know, and I'm like, "But you're genius. You're genius. Yeah. You all figured out how to make that happen. It was an idea you had, and you pulled it off. Now let's dump these out because you're going to die." You know, you know, that's the balance of being a parent. But but I think that now at age 16 and 19, I think those kids, they realize, like, yeah, you probably were doing the right thing. We hated you at times. But I, you know, I tried to get them to be agents of their own, you know, pursuits and curiosities. I will tell you, I gave in about middle school, like, oh gosh, you know, they're hard humans. And you know, there was more screen time in my house, when we'd be like, you know, if people knew how much you were letting them on the screen, you know, but parenting is hard. So, but it's something I think about all the time. Yeah.
Wow.
That is really, the tip of your it just makes you reflect, like growing up.
And it's just like a radical activity to do.
Yeah,
like I don't
to be bored.
Yeah, to like make your children.
Well, because I think once we hit that place where we're bored, until then we see something, and maybe it's we're seeing the clouds and we see them like creating animal shapes. Do you remember at that point where you did that, or you're yesterday, in the backyard? Because your parents sent you into the backyard, and oh, you're so ticked, and but then all of a sudden you notice a mound of ants. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of poking at it with a stick, and you're realizing, well, wait a minute, there's a whole system. That's what curiosity does. Yeah. And I think one of the things I talk about in that workshop is there's this thing called the wonder cycle. And the wonder cycle is fabulous, but we don't think about it as far as learning. But it starts with wonder, and it's curiosity and questioning. And here's what wonder is. Wonder is that moment, like you just said, where you walk outside. And sometimes we let ourselves do this, and artists do it best. Mm-hmm. You walk outside and you see something, and it stops you in your track. And you see like the shape of a cloud, or a rainbow can do that, or something even abject or gross. Or but we stop, and for one moment, we don't quite know what we're comprehending. So wonder is almost just a flash moment where we're in a state of disbelief. But what's beautiful about wonder is it is the pathway to curiosity.
Mm.
And so the minute you have that, you immediately are like, what the heck am I looking at? You might even pull out your phone and Google, and you know, but this is what artists do, and they honor it. Like, I love nothing more than following artists on Instagram, because artists see things no one else does. It might be the parking lot of Lowe's and those like paint patterns that, you know, when you patch up the parking lot, they'll see things. Like one of them that I have is an artist who saw Stranger Things, you know, in the first Stranger Things, all the lines on the wall, they were like, ooh, that reminds me of Stranger Things. Or an artist that walks out of their house at the same time every morning and just takes a photo of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And how that changes. And they'll just put a grid up. And you were like, damn, right. That's beauty.
Yeah.
But they help us see and slow down and access wonder, which then leads to curiosity, that then leads to questioning. And that's the wonder cycle that make us curious learners. So I'm often telling educators, where's wonder in your classroom? Because if it doesn't exist, you're not going to get to curiosity. And sometimes wonder can come in the form of a work of art or an ant farm, mm-hmm. or just take them on a walk around the block
yeah.
mm-hmm. and have them slowly look at the yeah. world around them.
Yeah. True. So. You talked about that in your TED Talk, too, in regards to, like, your husband.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You didn't say this, but I thought about it, and I was like, when I go into, like, those moments where I'm just, like, I look at one thing, and then it leads to another thing, and then I'm all of a sudden in, like, this paradigm of, like, four different, like, different studies about, like, the original thing that I was thinking about, and it's like you get obsessive yeah. about it.
Yeah.
And it's crazy how just a walk around the block
can that.
Cause you to think about one thing, the next thing, and then what's next.
Yeah, especially if you're intentional. I think we yeah. often get in our daily grinds, and, yeah. you know, I even walk to work, and I sometimes think, I don't even remember my walk to work
yeah.
because I was too focused on what meeting I had next, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's slowing down enough to be intentional, like artists are, to see the world, to actually yeah. be present.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the connection to mental health, right?
Yeah.
Like, the more we can be present, the more we think like artists, and we're engaged in a world in which we see the beauty. We also see the horror yeah. and the object, but we're present in that. And
yeah.
it can lead to us being, you know, more engaged, curious human beings.
Yeah, I yeah. think that's perfect, too, that you're saying being present, because I do believe in being, like, so intentional that it causes tension.
Yeah.
So if you're able to distinguish really the two and really find, like, your sweet spot in being present, then yeah. it really allows, like, it creates fun, which yeah. is that play that you mm-hmm. are creating.
Right. Like, absolutely.
Amazing.
Absolutely.
Amazing.
So on the form of play, why is, like, play so important? Not just for, like, obviously kids, but, like, for us as adults, like, why is that important, you know, just in, you know, daily lives and those
yeah,
sort of things?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny. I'm so glad you asked me this, because the first experimental project I did at Graham was to focus on play.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so often people will ask me, you know, I know your husband's an artist. Do you make art too? And I was like, yeah, but my art is actually my work.
Right.
Mm.
And yeah. and I really right. feel like, for folks, don't ever apologize for not making capital A art, because, you know, that we need to be making art with the thing we do every day, right? Ooh. We need to find that.
Mm.
And so I remember with my yeah. colleagues, you know, saying, well, maybe we could try this experiment. Just what if, you know, like, what if you're asking what if at work, you're playing.
Mm-hmm.
Play mm-hmm. is the creative process in action. It's when we get in a state of flow. Csikszentmihalyi is this great researcher who articulated that flow is when we lose, like, we lose sight of time. We're so engaged in the direction that a project is going that, like, the outside world doesn't kind of really even filter in, and hours can go by. You can not eat, you know, it can be that encompassing. And you see it in kids,
yeah.
like when they're in full play mode, you know, and superheroes, and they're doing their thing and Lego and right. But adults, you see it too, especially artists. And I think what I value about play is that we actually need scaffold as we become adults to play. That we've become so expected to just leave these rigid lives that don't have what if moments. That part of what I think we need to do as leaders in workplaces, as educators, is provide scaffolding for more what if moments.
Mm.
So, you know, the experiment I did at Graham was actually in our permanent collection galleries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with some colleagues, we came up with three what if moments right in the middle of the galleries, where we you know, an example is a group of paintings, and they're very shape oriented, abstract. And we said, what if you have the challenge and you could only choose, you know, there's a pile of shapes. You could only choose six shapes, but you had to make a composition. What would you come up with? And so people start playing. And pretty soon, you know, 30 seconds goes by, and 5 minutes, then three other people are sitting with them. And what I had is a great group of gallery associates who were my researchers. And I wanted to see, what did play look like in the galleries? What if we just gave a provocation and we let people play? And all of a sudden, you know, people start playing with these little provocations we put out. and they're laughing, or sometimes they're concentrating, or sometimes they're wanting the rest of their family to come join them because there's other opportunities to play. And for me, I think that's what we need to think about in our society today, is not like, let's kill the phone. We're not going to kill the phone. Yeah. It's not going away, right? But right. How do we actually reintroduce moments of play and joy and wonder? You know, when you see, you know, I think it's Joseph Boyd. No, it's not Joseph. I can't remember which artist said this, but he said, 1 + 1 = 3. Somebody said, what? And 1 + 1 = 3. Because 1 + 1, and then you've got the space in between those fingers. Mm-hmm. So 1 + 1 = 3. The space in between is the wonder moment where you realize, oh, if we're looking at space, this one plus the space in between, that's 3 spaces. And it's how we look at the world differently. And sometimes those aha moments, if we scaffold them, people will have them in the galleries. And I've got, you know, writings by gallery associates where people will be like, oh, wow, did you see that? And they hadn't taken the time, slowed down. They wouldn't have had that moment, and they wouldn't have played. Mm. But we all, as humans, we need play. It is, I think, the antidote to the crisis we have around depression and anxiety. It's not the solution. Right. But man, more play in our lives, more ways of you know, feeling like I did something, I contributed. It would have such huge impacts on our health and well-being.
So it reminds me, I was in New York last year, and I got a chance to go to the MoMA, and they had this kind of like an interactive like art piece, and it was like called Dial a Poem.
Ooh, yeah.
So it reminded me of that, but also like how important it is to have art in museums that are interactive, that mm-hmm. people can physically touch, or, you know, like interact with, instead of just looking at something and reading a description. I guess kind of talk about why that is so important to have more of in art museums.
Yeah.
Of course, in relation to play, but yeah.
Well, this goes back to that whole tension we experienced for years in museums. Museums mm-hmm. were like libraries. They were quiet spaces. They were hands-off spaces.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, I think those of us who studied education and studied creativity and understood, people want to participate. They want to be inspired, and mm-hmm. art can do that. But what if it's a catalyst to help us think through problems and think about bigger issues? So I'll give you an example that's in the galleries right now. And we really are committed to doing this in every gallery space. Mm. We want you to either have the opportunity to make or create something, or at least participate conceptually with an idea. So, for example, we have the show about the border, the Mexican-American border, with two artists. And it can be heavy, but it's also about humanity and these quests and these humans that have taken these quests for a better life, right? Mm-hmm. But we realized we didn't want to end it there. We needed an opportunity at the end of the exhibition to actually acknowledge that unless you're Indigenous, we have all come here. And we've all taken journeys.
Yeah.
And we've had to leave things behind. And so at the end of the exhibition, we ask you to reflect on that and leave us your stories of transition, of change, of when your family maybe arrived. Now that may be, you know, for some 100 years ago, and for some a generation, 2 generations ago. But then what starts to happen is you get people leaving their stories behind. And then visitors not only have just experienced this exhibition, but they're reading the stories of their neighbors. Mm. And, you know, every time I'm at the wall, I well up in tears, because it's such a beautiful, and there's this respectful thing that happens.
Yeah.
You know, where someone was saying, I'm here in West Michigan, and I've come from Ukraine, but I want to be home. Mm-hmm. This isn't quite home for me yet.
Yeah.
But I feel safe and I feel loved. But, you know, I still long for that place. And they left that. And then you've got other people commenting on that. And for me, that's we planted the seeds with the exhibition, but then we have to hand it back to our visitors and give them the opportunity. What are they thinking about? What are they sharing? What are they learning? Give them that space.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it might be an opportunity to create, but sometimes it's, you know, again, writing and putting your story down.
Yeah. So letting them water it.
Yeah.
Water the seeds.
Yeah.
So it brought a question about, because I, you know, you've seen museums, you had, you know, those type of things. I've always been curious, like, what do you guys do with the information that you get from that?
Yeah, yeah.
I think you definitely, you know, describe that, kind of answer that question in terms of, like, you know, us getting to experience what people have already written. But I guess I'm curious from, you know, a curator or standpoint, or just, you know, being, you know, executive wise, like, what do you guys do with those stories? Like, how does that influence or, you know, add to, you know, maybe future exhibitions or just in general?
Well, I will say, museums are hoarders, and it becomes an issue because, you know, you have to make space for more people, so you take them down, but you've got these stories, and so museums aren't good about getting rid of stuff, so we end up holding on to a lot. But what I love about the changing nature of social media in museums, so Nick is a new employee. He's doing great work, and almost the minute he started at Graham, he realized, like, we need to share some of these stories.
Mm-hmm.
It's great that you all see the exhibition and what the artists are making, but I'm going to also share some of the stories about what's happening here. And I think that then expands our learning, and it expands the role of the museum. I mean, we have to see social media as far more than just promoting our next program. Mm. It's a learning tool. It's a way to more deeply engage. So then what can happen is then someone else can decide, I'm going to share my story on social media. And it just extends this big provocation that the artists were interested in. They wanted us to think about the border, not the political state of the border, but this idea that we're all going to have to transition in lives, and we're going to be in spaces where we're not welcome or we're not accepted. And how do we tolerate that? How do we understand our place and that we're valuable human beings, right? So I think, you know, the more we can create a platform using some of those stories, the better. And do we have, would I love to have, like, some sort of archive where people could go back? Yes.
Yeah,
we don't have it yet. Hold tight. We'll see where we go in the future.
But I think it's interesting because in our last board meeting, you know, we obviously, Nick got to meet, you know, the board members, and he was talking about how, like, you know, wanting to bring the art museum to other people, right? So in terms of using social media to bring the art to people without them having to, or, you know, some that not be able to physically, you know, show up at the art museum. And I think that was just important, but I guess kind of talk about why you think that isn't so important. Being, obviously, you have the space, you have those things, but, you know, being able to bring the art to people as much as possible.
Yeah. I think it's two part. It's one, we have to kind of break down that art is this elite group of people. Yes, there are artists that are trained in there. This is what their career is, but we're all creatives. And I think what Nick sees, and you know, that's why we need to be hiring, you know, him and the people like Michael. Michael's our new manager for community engagement. They see the role of the art museum through very different lenses. You know, one of the things I loved in my old institution is we tried an experiment once on social media. We found out that there was this Instagram, an international Instagram group that would give each other challenges. And there'd be like prompts around, you know, like trying to capture the sun in a particular way. Or they were visual people, but they weren't artists, but they loved sharing these profound prompts. So we had an exhibition of artists from New York who had a similar practice back in the 1930s and 40s. And it was called the Photo League of New York. And we actually found a whole bunch of the prompts the Photo League artists had used. And so we decided, why don't we partner with this international Instagram group and use those same prompts? And all of a sudden it takes off. And we are collecting thousands of images from across the globe, like from our own hometown, but across the globe, where people were taking those same prompts that artists had used, you know, decades before. And our curators at the time, smart people, were like, let's curate a show of this. Mm. And they dug That's through cool. those thousands of photographs. And most of these folks were just like, the way they came to photography was through their phone. Right. You know, they didn't consider themselves a photographer, but they started to capture, they started to see the world mm-hmm. differently. They started to capture the world through that lens of curiosity. And so our curators selected, and we actually did this mini exhibition, and we used it as an opportunity to say, sometimes you just need to be in the moment and figure out a way to do it. And mm-hmm. and that was what happened. And I think that's what you'll start to see more of as we go down these paths, is how do we engage? We even had a little opening, and we were surprised. We had two people fly in internationally because they were so honored to be selected for this Instagram, you know, but that's the flattening that's happening. There's no longer capital A artists and lowercase a artists. We're all creating. Yeah. And it's like, what work just moves the world? And that's how museums are thinking and behaving differently, is looking at that through a different lens.
Absolutely.
That's awesome. Yeah. Really cool.
Where's that going to go? So is there anything specifically at when you were, you know, in Columbus? And yeah, I mean, you obviously gave some examples, but like something that you did that you really are proud of that you did there.
Yeah. I think, you know, I was given an opportunity to play, and I appreciate that. And I love my former director who valued, you know, taking a risk, right? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things I did was I developed a Center for Creativity, which is a space. It was like a homeroom, a space that we could really focus on what does creativity mean and how do we cultivate it. Right. But with that, I started working specifically with educators and saying, and this goes to your point, Outfield, the museum, we can't do this alone. So what if we partnered with educators who want to see a change in education, who know that what's happening right now in their classrooms, you know, teaching to the test, it's not working. It's not preparing our kids for the lives they're going to live. And so we started pulling together educators, and about 75 educators a year would work with us. And it was called Teaching for Creativity. And these would be educators from high school civics classes, and it would be elementary school and early childhood, but they knew something had to change. And so what we did is work together to create tools to use art as catalysts for thinking differently and creating, you know, courageous, curious classrooms. To this day, it's the work they're doing that makes me most proud, is that, you know, I could start a ripple effect, and I still see these educators kind of changing the world.
That's good.
Absolutely. Yep. So now I want to kind of change the focus to Grand Rapids. And just kind of a few things that I feel like we have talked about, but like specifically like an artist council, can you talk about why that's important, especially where, you know, where you just came from? And yeah, just the importance of it in general, but I think also, you know, kind of having that in, you know, the space here at Grand Rapids.
Yeah. So a couple things I'm learning about Grand Rapids. You know, we were talking about the weather earlier, but summers are amazing and that sort of thing. But one of the things, I had to do some deep dives when I got here. And, you know, one of the deep dives is like looking at our budget and analyzing where the revenue sources are coming from and where they're not. And I saw that the way we evaluated our revenue sources was four quadrants in Columbus. You have earned revenue, which is like ticket sales, or if somebody rents the museum for a wedding, that's earned revenue. You have endowment, which endowment is if somebody leaves you like $1 million and you just use that principal to spend every year, and you leave the million in, but you have that money, and it's a good long-term source of funds. Right. And then you have contributed are people that give you gifts, and, you know, memberships and things that kind of keep us sustained. Except for Columbus had another category called public funding. And I get to Grand Rapids and I don't see public funding. And I'm like, wait a minute, we should have public funding in Grand Rapids too, don't we? And so what I realized is that across the U.S., if you look at Europe, for example, Europe has something like 76% of budgets for museums and cultural organizations is covered by public funding. So most of those organizations are public, or you know, they're government, they're run by the government, and they invest in their museums and their arts, you know, in other places. In the U.S., we do, but to a lesser degree. And so on average, a museum in the U.S. has between about 12 to 18% of their budgets are covered by public funding. Often that's at a city level, a county level, state level, or even federal. But the combination is on a given year, you have a, you know, you just know that you've got a stream of funds that cover a portion of your budget. In cities like Cleveland, it's even higher because they started that work decades and decades and decades before. So there might be multiple streams of funding. I came from a city where we were unhappy with the percentage of our budgets that in the cultural orgs was more like 6 to 8%. We were like, we need to do better. So we worked with the city and we found a stream of funds through a ticket fee that could every year generate some money, which is great. Except for then you get to a city like Grand Rapids, and this is a very generous city, and it's a city that cares about the arts. It's just for one reason or another, we never figured out a way for public funding to be a portion of that support. Right. What that means, though, is I think we've never then had a arts council, or we had one for a moment, and it wasn't functioning in a way that was supportive of our needs. And so it kind of fizzled off. But in a place like Columbus, the Arts Council is the glue for the arts community. They are the mechanism in which funding comes through and goes back out, but they're also the mechanism to support living artists and ensure that we're keeping artists in the area. So they even generate another bucket of funds for artists. And artists, so the organizations are applying for grants out of the organization bucket, but they have an entire bucket of funds and all these different ways that artists can go, and it makes their lives sustainable. So, you know, I personally know artists that every year they'll get a grant for just doing new work, new projects. So if you want to write a new piece of music, a new play, so you get these artists that we want to keep them in this community because they're making work about living in that community. Writers, spoken word artists, all these folks are—they're emblematic of the culture in which they live, right? But we need to support them so they don't have to go to other cities to get the funding because other cities have the funding. So it keeps them in a community. But it also, for example, there are grants where you can just be like, I need supplies, and here are the supplies I need, and you can, and almost everyone will get a supply grant. And that's just, like, can you imagine how that would impact change if lives. You need a new camera, if you need something, you make a case for it, you talk about what you want, what work you want to do, and they're like, all right, here's a check. And, you know, I make it sound simple. It's not. Grant writing is never fun. But but we need something like that in Grand Rapids. And here's what I will tell you is I think this is a kind of an amazing time. A lot of folks are coming from away saying, wait a minute, I think we need this. And the folks that are here are like, yeah, no, we need it. So we're working with city. We're having the conversations. We're starting conversations. We're doing impact study on the economic nature of how the arts contribute to this community. And then once we have that data, I think this direction may start moving. But I think especially the artists that are listening to this podcast know, you know, definitely we need to speak up, and we need to be at the table for these conversations that are about to take place.
Absolutely. Wow, that's crazy. I didn't realize that even existed. Do you know the percentage of museums in the United States that do that versus like the ratio between the ones that do and don't?
I bet I could dig, but no, I don't know off the top of my head. No, I know that the average is, you know, between 15% and 18%, which means, you know, in Columbus at one point we were 8%, but then we moved up to 12% to 15%. Yeah. And so then you have Cleveland that was, you know, probably higher. And but what I think it indicates is that if our society values the role artists play, to create dynamic communities,
for sure,
to be places where we value ideas, we need to find ways to invest in those humans and their capacity to make our world a better place.
Absolutely.
Do you think that the Graham, or maybe not even the Graham, but the community in Grand Rapids valued that before you arrived?
Yeah, I actually do. And I think part of the reason we're in this situation is actually because we were different from a lot of other communities. And that, that difference wasn't a bad thing. It was just that there was an incredible amount of generosity coming from a number of, you know, arts-loving families that, that made things happen. And so I don't think we ever thought, oh, we should also be talking about public funding, because public funding is our future. It's, it's, you know, and so we just kind of settled with what we had. But I think to be stronger, we need to, we need all four of those, because you never know what's going to happen. And I think COVID was a perfect example of, you know, funding changed for a lot of organizations. Right. People maybe weren't able to donate as much. And, you know, so you need... you need all four coming in to make sure we're sustainable, because the last thing we want is to start to see arts organizations, you know, not exist and because they can't keep the bills paid.
Right. Thank you for answering that question.
Yeah.
I was trying to ask that as politely as possible.
You did. So.
So on that note of like the local artist, I guess, What's the importance of, you know, a Graham, in terms of for the local artist? Like, what's the whether that be exhibitions, whatever it is, like, how is that? Why is that important for the local art museum to be a catalyst for the local artist?
Yeah, I think what you need is you need a wide swath of galleries, art spaces, pop-ups. You need an art museum or two. You know, we used to have UICA, which was far more focused on contemporary and living artists. But once, when you have a robust infrastructure and all those organizations are, you know, getting some level of support so they can exist and do the right work, what we create is a scaffolding for artists to start to build up. I think one of the challenges is communities like ours, sometimes there's like maybe a step here, but then there's like three steps missing, and then there might be a step here, and then, you know, Graham is all the way up here. But if you don't, you got a
foundation.
You got to build your exhibition record. You've got to be seen in more places. You've got to have exhibitions that have been critiqued or maybe reviewed, you know, like, because what the places like Graham are trying to do is find the exhibitions and put together exhibitions where they're catalyst exhibitions. They're changing the world. They're pushing boundaries. They're and so what artists do is they're going up that ladder, is they're testing their own practice. They're trying something. Oh, that worked. Let me try something else now. Let's see how people respond to that. Then I'm gonna do a little, you know. But that's the growth of an artist, is in showing their work to people, getting that feedback, evolving, realizing like, here's what I could do to my work that would actually address bigger issues or challenges, or dig into something aesthetically that no one else has before. And when artists aren't given those kind of all those opportunities to show, it's why artists in New York, you know, there's a lot of different levels in which you can be showing. The smaller the town, the harder that gets. Which, you know, I think we have galleries, but sometimes the leaps between or getting into that gallery might be difficult. Right, so then we need art spaces. And then we, you know, but it starts off with having coffee houses that are, you know, I'm giving you a perfect example. Yeah, the amount of artists I know who started in some sort of restaurant or a coffee house, it's important. Right. And many of them maybe started in a church basement before that. But we got to have every level kind of celebrating artists, showing new work. True. And then, but that's, again, where an artist council comes in, because we then could have a community calendar where all these events are happening. Mm. And if you want to engage deeply in the arts, how do you find out about everything? So it's a complicated system and web. I think Graham, you know, we're talking a lot about how do we fill some of those gaps.
Yeah.
You know, our spaces don't explode overnight. You know, we're usually booked 3 years out for an exhibition. So, you know, we're the least flexible, but we are doing things like Bloom. And Bloom was a recognition that there are some really interesting artists in our community, you know, starting to push the boundaries that maybe aren't getting the kind of exposure they need. Mm. And we have a space that right now, you know, we're not exactly sure what we're going to be doing with it. It may end up becoming like a gift shop or something, because it was the space that was used for that. But in the meantime, we realized, what if we just worked with some of these really interesting artists and gave them a platform to show that is in the museum? Because it's us saying, we validate that these artists are legitimate, interesting artists that need spaces. Right. They also need to be collected, because being in collections matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it was a pop-up moment, and it was an experiment, but it was a good experiment.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, from here, it's us continuing to question, like, how do we make more space? Could we apply some pressure on some other friends? You know, could we do some other things? And I think we're all going to have to solve this together.
Yeah.
But it's back to, let's all think differently about how we move forward.
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
So lastly, maybe the last thing, but so the Graham just started a DEI acquisition fund. Can you talk to us about that? But also just why that is important, given the structure of how, you know, artists, you know, acquired and those type of things.
Yeah, it's one of the systemic challenges in museums. And I didn't learn this till maybe even in the past decade, like just how systemic it is.
Mm.
So the way we typically acquire work into a collection is either someone donates it to the museum, which is, I would say, about half of the work comes probably through that means, you know, and sometimes it's someone who's bequeathed it upon their death, or someone who's a big collector who realizes, like, all right, my walls are full, and you know, but I love this stuff and I don't want to sell it, but it needs to have a home, you know, somewhere. Yeah. So some work comes to us that way. But we, with the work that we purchase, one of my jobs as director is to find funds for the work that we purchase. And what's been lovely, and this is, I think, you know, part of the generosity, is in this community and elsewhere, often people will have some money and they'll say, I want to give this money to Graham, and I'm going to give you a nice lump sum, and I want you to use that money to collect the things that I was passionate about, because I want to see those things in the Graham. But what happens after years is then you'll have a pocket of money that's for 1890s to 1930s impressionism, which is great. Or, you know, like these buckets of money that are specifically for these areas. But then you realize, like, there weren't a lot of Black artists working in impressionism during that time. And I'm really interested in diversifying the narrative. Even if it's a narrative about artists working in America in the early 1900s, but they weren't maybe making impressionist work, but they might have been. So one of the challenges is we gave our curators made this call. They wanted to say, if we're spending money, we want 75% of that money to diversify our collection.
Yes.
Right now, 80% of the work in our collection is white male artists.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's through the history of time. Yeah. Those were the artists, you know, white Western artists were the ones being purchased and uplifted. And a lot of art, it wasn't that women and artists of color weren't making art, but either it's lost or we're just now finding them, which we are still finding artists, which is fabulous. But what do you do when 80%? We need to make a shift and we need to make it quick. And we need to start being really intentional about that until... as I shared with Alfield when we first met, like, Alfield, I got a problem. I don't have a bucket of money that is for just artists of color. And in order, I have a small bucket. And for the past 3 years, we used, we only purchased artists of color. Mm. But we only purchased 13 works of art in, you know, that time. And that's because that bucket was so small.
Yeah.
And I can't just deplete it and not have any. So I, you know, I'm leaving and hoping it grows a little bit. But but it was a realization. Well, what if we had a fund? Because when you have a fund, it's a visible place you want to grow. So for example, a couple of years ago, we created a fund called the Field Trip Fund. Mm-hmm. And as schools were less and less inclined to come to museums and have these experiences, we realized one of the hindrances was the amount of money it costs to pay for a bus.
Right.
So we started a fund, and when donors would look, they could see these funds and they'd say, yeah, I care about kids going to the museum. I want to make a donation. I want my money to go towards that fund. So we realized if we could create a fund, we could help people think about the fact that diversification of collections is going to take money. An investment, and we needed to make it visible. So we launched, Alfield was my co-host, and we launched a fund about a month ago. And, you know, at this point, we're closing in on like $12,000, which is, you know, no drop in the bucket. It's kind of an
incredible.
And I will tell you, a huge portion of them are black and brown donors. Yep. And, you know, I think it is really nice. And it says a lot about what we care about in the community.
Yeah.
So, but it's important for us to make that visible.
Yeah.
And make some of the challenges that museums face more visible as we begin to try to change to address the needs.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think the fact that it exists is just enough to say what needs to be said.
Yeah.
Like,
right. And I think the important thing is if it's a collective where it's like, okay, everybody is getting to put in.
Yeah.
And not just like actually be part of it, but you're like, you know, you're part of something that's bigger than yourself.
Absolutely.
That's important. Too.
And it's very different from how a lot of those other collections started or the funds. It was usually one individual with health, right? Yep. And so this is a fund. I mean, we've got gifts in there from $15 to a couple $1,000s. And and wonderful. So it tells you something about like, this is, I like the language. It's a collective of givers. And it's a movement. And that feels really different. It feels like we as a community are going to work to solve this and create more opportunity to purchase the work that we need.
Absolutely.
Good.
Yeah.
And then lastly, just I guess the importance of representation in the art museum, not just in terms of specifically obviously the art that's there, but you know on you know that fund specifically. I think why is that so important to have? Especially, I think generally, but I think especially in our city, specifically as Grand Rapids, how it is. So,
yeah, I think I learned this. I've given tours all my life, and there's nothing like having a group of kids get off the bus, and they're kind of awed with the building. But there's a moment where they will see the representation of themselves on the walls. After maybe as a kid of color, you've grown up and you've seen the white wall of all the teachers that or principals of your school and the white wall of all the university presidents. And, you know, typically when you look on the walls of an important place, you see white men. And there's something incredibly powerful when a kid actually walks in and You see yourself. You see a you know, a strong black woman, or you see a you know, Latinx, you know, kind of young man. I mean, it matters.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And so, you know, while we're diversifying our collection, that may mean some of the artists are abstract artists and you don't necessarily see a figurative. But we are being really intentional about, we also need the work that helps people see the black body, the, you know, the representation of someone that represents them. Mm-hmm. And so we're doing a lot of work to see how do we make that happen. And that's going to be part of this fund too.
Absolutely.
I love that.
Absolutely. I don't have any other.
I just enjoyed listening. Yeah. This is like absolutely in a class, a master class.
Oh, that's awesome. Literally. And I, you know, I'm just going to state this. I researched you all, and I really love the dynamic the three of you have together, and the respect that you give to the interviewee. I knew I could come and share with you all today. So I appreciate you.
We all love each other.
Yeah, it's clear.
Absolutely. Anything that you want to, you know, plug or
please?
Oh, good idea.
Yeah, plug it in.
I do have one that I want to plug because you know he's on my mind right now. There's an artist that I'm pretty excited about that's coming this summer. His name is Mario Moore, and Mario he's a Detroit based artist, and he's been making art that really explores kind of the history and narrative of black culture. There's a body of work, for example, that I'm super excited for you all to see. He was researching how black enslaved people came to the Detroit, Michigan, you know, how they got here. Mm. And it was through the fur trade. They were brought here to work and, you know, they were enslaved. And what he's learned, though, is that created, you know, quite a bit. That was the beginning of kind of an embedded community and culture, especially in the Detroit area. Mm. But then he had this realization, and he talked about when he went away to school, he kind of realized that maybe only in Detroit does, you know, when grandmas and moms go to the grocery store, they wear the furs. And he was
very
like,
very much Detroit.
Yeah. And he was like, there's got to be this tie between that trauma and, you know, how many of us that, you know, came to this place and that experience of like, today I wear this fur as a power emblem.
Right, that shift, yeah.
And so, you know, just one body of work in this exhibition is these individuals wearing furs in these really interesting settings. So just come to see. And he's got a lot of different bodies of work that digs into all kinds of stories and narratives. But he's an artist that's making us think and making Michigan proud, you know. And I think finding artists like that and celebrating him, I think he's going to be one of the names that we're all talking about in about 5 years on a national scene. But it's
absolutely.
But he is Michigan all the way, and he loves us, and he loves this community. He wants to be a part of the dialogue, and he's not interested in bailing and heading to the coast, which I really appreciate because that is the allure, I think, as artists start to do well. It's like, you know, can I stay in this place and still make work about this place in which my identity is so rooted? And I you know.
It's difficult.
Yeah, it is difficult. Yeah. And so I appreciate that, you know, he's sticking with it. So.
And that will be opening April?
I think April 29th. Bush. But everybody go check the website and double check.
Sure,
but
we'll put it'll be up in the notes.
Definitely through the summer too. So
sure, for
amazing.
Sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, again, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for just this. This was amazing.
Well, I loved it
so much. I was like,
yeah.
A million out of 10.
Literally.
We could do this all night.
Absolutely. Seriously.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Crazy.
You made me very comfortable. Thank you.
I appreciate it. That's good to hear. Until next time, y'all.
See y'all.
storyteller too.
Oh, that's great. Seriously.